welcome back to another exciting episode of Extra Feature Interview. Today we have a fabulous guest all the way from sunny California. Why sit here in snow? Not fair. His film Crisis Hotlines, where he's heard to discuss Mark Schwab. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It is awesome being here.
So I guess we got to start at the beginning. This is a heavy topic.
Well, as far as how it got made, or as far as like how it started, and
just in general, like to sit down and go, I'm going to write about a crisis hotline. That sounds like something somebody should enjoy.
Well, the story of Crisis Hotline and how it got made, it's funny, through this COVID pandemic, I'm actually writing a book about the making of it, as far as all, you know, all behind the scenes things and what inspired it. But essentially, when I first wrote it in 2017, I guess, was the first draft I completed. The main reason I wrote that specific film was because there were a couple reasons. One, we had a deadline that we, or an opportunity where it was May of 2017. And the opportunity was if we could turn in a rough draft of a feature film by September 30th of that same year, we had a very good shot of getting a sales rep that would rep it at the American film market. So that was the gauntlet thrown down to us. And we had made 4 feature films and a feature-length documentary at that point, our production, Diamond in the Rough Films, me and my two business partners. And so we had this challenge, and with no script, no nothing at this point. And so I told the person who could make this opportunity happen, I said, well, I do have this kind of idea about a kind of a race against time, you know, kind of a psychosexual thriller, where, you know, a young man is overdosed. He's on a crisis hotline and they have to try and find him before he dies. And we tell that story and flashback of what led up to that. And she said, well, that's a really good idea, because at that time, the LGBT thriller genre was really, there was a demand for it at that point. And as far as independent films. And so she said, that sounds really good. And it was actually, I had the original scaffolding of that plot from a movie I did way back in 2001. And so this was something I could retool it. I could update it. I could make it a lot more thrillery and do it quickly. So I wrote the first draft in about 6 days. And we were off and running pretty quickly after that.
So I want to back up with a couple of things you stated on. You discussed you're writing a book about the making of this.
Yes.
Now, is the book for independent filmmakers, or is it just to go for general market, or where's your book's direction?
I would say right now, if I'm looking at it right now, I would say it would gear towards independent filmmakers or people who are just interested in how independent films get made at that level. There aren't a lot of books about that, actually. And I love books like that. I love reading about the making of movies, whatever they are. And so it's kind of a genre that I'm thirsty for anyway. But there are people that told me I should write it, that I would have something to add, or maybe some advice about what that experience is, because I think there's a lot of misconceptions about independent film. A lot of independent filmmakers are still living in, you know, 1993. You know, I get it in Sundance, it gets a $2 million deal and I'm off to the races, and it just isn't quite like that anymore. And they still think it is, or they want it to be. And so it's kind of a guidepost in that way too, about what the landscape's really like right now.
So I'm going to go back and keep giving me points to work with. Nostalgia. Sure. Do you find too many independent filmmakers rely on nostalgia? Because you're going back to the $2 million film, 1993, yes. But there weren't that many people making independent films.
Independent filmmaking today, the tools are much more accessible. Back in when I went to film school, even into the mid to late 90s, you still had to shoot on film, basically. And shooting on film required a lot of craft. It requires a lot more skill as far as just loading the film mag properly, for example, getting the proper focal lengths and making sure it's exposed. And there was just a lot more that went into it, in my opinion. And so there were less independent films being made back in the early 90s. That's true. But if you could get one up, there was a lot of opportunity if you did it well. There was less. And when I did a feature film in 2001, and I shot it on a Canon XL1 on mini DV tape. And when I did that, and the fact that I actually got it into some film festivals and actually got it, it got a couple of awards and stuff. A lot of filmmakers were shocked that I actually was able to do that on mini DV tape. There was that little going on. And so, yes, it's definitely, of course, there are way more films being made, way more product, because the tools are more accessible, but they still are living in that story because it was a great story. The story of how Blair Witch got done, or Clerks, or Slacker, all of those movies. It's like an American success story. Even John Waters, these are filmmakers that got there purely on the basis of their films and got celebrated for it now. And they also had a lot of help. They had a lot of help. I mean, Kevin Smith has said if he did Clerks today, he wouldn't be anywhere, you know, as a filmmaker. So it's a very different landscape.
So, okay. Last time I'm going back, because you're bringing up good things.
No problem.
You said you wrote this film about writing for demand.
Yes, at the time. Yes, so it was suggested to be.
Mm-hmm. I just want to go back. Do you normally write for demand, or normally you just write what you feel you should be writing?
That's a good question. Unlike, I think, one way in which I'm a little bit different, I guess, than most independent filmmakers is I write scripts out of just pure necessity. I would much rather read scripts, have scripts offered to me, you know, look through them, maybe rewrite them a little bit. I don't relish the idea of writing my own scripts necessarily. I do it because I want to practice my craft. And the scripts that I do get occasionally, or that people put in front of me, are not there. They're not something that I want to spend a year of my life on. So if I'm going to spend a year of my life on something, and that's basically what you're talking about on a feature film, and that's if you're shooting it, that's if you're working on it all the time, full time. If you're going to do it, if you have to do it on the weekends, like most filmmakers have to do, you know, add another year onto that, you're talking 2 years all told, from blank page to hopefully distribution deal. And so for me, I'm going to write something that usually I haven't seen before. You know, if I haven't seen it before, that interests me. And I will write something that I absolutely want to spend that level of energy on and that level of interest on.
So I don't know if this film came out before the pandemic or not, but maybe you can help me out if I ask the question. Obviously, you're doing a crisis hotline. Obviously, people are familiar with this topic and people do this for a living. What was their reaction after seeing the film? Did they think you wrote it well? Did they think you missed things? What was your feedback?
Yeah, the feedback, it's interesting. When I originally did the research in 2001 for the previous film, which is very, very different from Crisis Hotline, I knew someone who worked for a Crisis Hotline in San Francisco, and I got to ask him a ton of questions, and he was super helpful. This time, I did a lot of research as far as how they operate now, and things had changed dramatically as far as how crisis hotlines, their experiences today as opposed to 2001. Very, very different today from my research. I haven't had any, and a lot of what is in the film is based on actual testimonies from crisis hotline operators. And so there is, it's accurate, at least to the point of what other crisis hotline operators have experienced, but it's still the actual workings of it is not gone into too much detail. But I haven't had anybody say, oh my God, this is totally wrong. You know, which is, it shouldn't be. I mean, it's based on my research, current research.
So, at one point during the film, I wrote this down. Are there real steps to dating? Hiking, coffee, dinner? What was the last one? Yeah, are there real steps to dating, or did you just make those up?
Well, they're steps that I've seen a lot of my friends do. So that's based on kind of anecdotal experience. It may be a little bit of mine as well, as far as kind of what I like to do. It has been a while since I've dated somebody. It's been many years, but, but I think it's still fairly universal given at the time what I've observed in my friends at that time as far as how they went through courtship.
Did you find by doing your research in the gay community, is it different? Did you think of things differently? Did you look at things differently? Or did you say, that works for everybody, we're going to do that?
Well, for me, it's interesting because my husband and I've been together now for coming up on 8 years, married for two of those. And do I think it's different? I think there are some differences. I think there are. I think how couples connect and how they build a relationship, the building blocks are fairly similar in from what I've seen and what I've observed. But I think as far as how people meet, how they go about trying to integrate each other's lives, I think there's maybe a little bit of difference, mainly because of societal's view of it. So it's as different as they want to make it. And a lot of, I have had, you talk about feedback, some of the feedback I did get on the film, surprisingly, was people actually thought I was like a right-wing conservative with it. They looked at it as that I was judging, dating apps, and I was judging sex, and I that couldn't be further from the truth. I just want to go on record right now.
Wow.
I think that said everything about the viewer and not about me.
I'd say so.
Yeah, but a lot of my work, especially this, I think this film so far has gone over better with straight audiences than gay audiences, mainly because it seems like I have gotten feedback from gay men that have wanted me to be much more political, have a serious agenda. And as a filmmaker, I'm not really that interested in agendas. I'm interested in telling an absorbing story that you have to find out how it ends. And I do like all different genres. I'm not, I want to work in every genre for sure. If I could, it's on my IMDb page. Sidney Lumet is one of my heroes as a filmmaker because he made the movies about the story and about the acting. It was never about him. And he did everything. He did all of it. He did The Wiz. He did Prince of the City. He did Death Trap. Network. These are all very varied movies. And also he went out on a great film, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, which is a fantastic movie. And he worked right to the end healthily. So I would love to live that life if I could. Kind of a long-winded answer, but I think it gets it across.
Well, it gives you something to work with again. Yeah. So you're telling me that most gay people are telling you that you're too conservative. And I don't know, did they give you an answer where they get that from this film? I thought this film was normal. Like, I enjoyed the story. I didn't see a political agenda here in any way. So I don't know where that was coming from.
Well, they look at it as they thought I was making a judgment on, all sorts of things like group sex and being, it was sex negative. It was drug negative. It was party negative. And it really isn't. I'm telling you, really, audience members, it really isn't. There are aspects of that to the story, but it's not a reflection. It's not a political agenda. And I think that's what I see in a lot of films today. They're really pitched very emotionally high as much as possible. They want to accomplish something. And there's nothing wrong with that. But for me, I just kind of want to tell a story that people can get into for 90 minutes and enjoy it and maybe be intrigued and interested, and that's it. I don't need to try and tell them what they're supposed to think or what they're supposed to feel or anything like that.
I have to tell the viewer, I think whoever's saying this is, they're wrong. I'm a straight guy. I enjoyed this film. I didn't see any political agenda at all throughout this film. So that's just to be ludicrous.
I think so too. I was shocked actually when I heard it from more than a couple people. They're like, we think you made this is a conservative's, wet dream type of thing. It's like, what? That wasn't the intention.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to do it. I thought you did a good job, but just
thank you.
We're here, the viewer. I think you need the film to have crisis of some kind or it's not worth watching.
True. And you know, one thing too, I'll let you in on one, you know, in case some people might not know this, but Crisis Hotline was not the original title of the film. The title of the film was originally called Shadows in Mind, was what it was. Yeah, that was the original title. I was inspired by Trouble in Mind, the Alan Rudolph film from 1985. Really interesting movie, by the way, and you know, which is a really moody, atmospheric puzzle box of a movie. And that title really fits the movie, I think, because that was another issue we had. Because now the distributor called it Crisis Hotline. That was their, and they had every right to do that, of course. But for me, you know, it gives the impression that it's like a slasher film, and it really isn't. It's much more of like, what did a friend of mine said, it's like a miniature Eyes Wide Shut kind of is.
Yes, I can see that. Definitely agree with that.
Yeah. And so that was kind of interesting that it was marketed like that. So some of the horror film sites that picked it up went, well, you know, what is this? I mean, it really threw them for a tizzy, you know, kind of, they didn't know what to make of it, to say the least.
So we're discussing here, let's discuss your pacing. I find you've definitely selected as a director, a certain pacing throughout your film. Like I find it moves at the same pace, almost always, even at the end, I find you're not rushing. You're laying this out like I always want to say like you're icing a cake. You put icing on it. You're waiting. Oh, maybe I'll put something else on it now. Okay, I'm going to come back and add something else. So you're almost like layering. You have a beautiful cake. You could serve it right like that, but you like to add constantly. And was that your plan as a director to constantly not go too fast, but to just keep bringing the viewer in? Let me give you a little bit more.
And yes, a absolutely. Bit more. Yeah, that was always intentional. Especially what was so great was, it was absolutely designed to be atmospheric, because my films in the past had been much more, you know, very cerebral, very, very art type movies, with no commercial viability at all. But it doesn't mean they weren't good, you know, and that they played in festivals. It was fine. But this was a bit of a more of attempt by me to try and get something a little more mainstream. For me anyway, this is mainstream, if you can believe it. And I always wanted, and because I got a great cinematographer, Dante Yor was the first time I really got to work, and his crew too. This was a Hollywood experienced crew that I got to work with. And that was a real eye opener for me as far as being able to work with that level of equipment and that level of ability of someone who could design shots. And I told him right off the bat, I said, I really want to create kind of like a world building, a very hermetically sealed world that, you know, that is completely our own. And I want the viewer to be able to just soak it in as much as possible. And because a lot of films today are ADD cinema to me, they're shouting at you constantly, and it assumes you can't pay attention. And I just don't believe that. I believe an audience can pay attention. And so in a way I am kind of feeding them their vegetables here as far as you know, you're going to have to pay attention to what's going on, and you're going to have to soak it in. And that should add to the whole experience. So that was intentional. Absolutely. And I was just really lucky that, because me and Mark Balunas, my co-producer, co-business owner, we both edited the film at the same time to make that deadline. He edited all of the crisis center scenes, and I edited all the scenes that weren't in the crisis center. And Mark did a perfect job. Every scene he sent me was spot on for what I wanted. And no one can ever tell that two people edited that film at the same time.
No, definitely not.
So we were we've known each other for over 30 years. We go back to high school. So we do kind of speak a similar language, but I was just so impressed that Mark got that from the outset. He knew what I wanted from the pacing, and he delivered perfectly.
So you brought up a Hollywood crew. Do you find that helped you as a director to formulate your ideals?
It was vital. The success the film has had, you know, however anyone wants to measure that, there's no way it happens without that crew. Because what happened with that, I'll tell you, the very first day of shooting, this will encapsulate it very well. So I began working with Dante, and I was immediately impressed. Dante's incredibly smart. He knows exactly what he's doing. His crew were excellent people. All of them were really, really great. And the first day because it was so tight, we shot the movie in 11 days, which is incredibly fast. I don't recommend that. Every filmmaker out there, it's you're really putting pressure on yourself to do that. And because of that, Dante didn't have much time at all to really look at the locations. I mean, it was just difficult. And so the very first day, I'm excited. All the toys are getting set up. It's looking great. And I do my very first, you know, setup. And I said, yeah, we're going to do it. And Dante kind of looks at me and says, yeah, I don't know if that'll work. And I said, okay, well, what do you think? He says, well, what if you did this? And I said, oh, that's much better. Yeah, we'll do that. Okay. So the first day was a lot of that. And we didn't even make half the shots. And I did all the scheduling. I do all the first ADing as well. And I was totally depressed after that because I was like, first of all, did I even know what I was doing? No. You know, I mean, he had to fix every setup and we're already half a day behind, you know, when we didn't have it. So the next morning, exhausted, because we started off with a lot of night shoots going from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m., which were really tiring. And I went over to where he was staying, you know, bleary-eyed, and he was wide awake, ready to go. And I said, Dante, God, we got to talk, you know. And he said, well, what? I said, well, that first day was just bad. He said, what are you talking about? It went great. I said, well, but you had to fix all of my stuff and we're halfway behind. He says, okay. He says, first of all, man, he said, we're going to make that up today. We'll make up what we did yesterday today, which we did, by the way. But he says, we'll make that up. He says, but the second thing, Mark, he said, I'm glad you're talking about this with me. He said, because all of your setups were absolutely fine. There was nothing wrong with your setups. All my job is to present you with an alternative. I will do it any way you want. And he says, I'm just appreciative that you thought what I came up with was better. He says, but you're fine. You know what you're doing. Everything's going great. And that changed everything right there for me, because then it became a collaboration completely. And he said the perfect thing at the perfect time. And so after that, we were really going full steam ahead.
Very interesting. Mm-hmm. I like that. We discussed night shoots. Now, did most of the night shoots occur because of the crisis hotline center where you had to shoot?
Yeah, it's funny because I originally picked that location, first of all, because we could get access to it and I thought it worked perfectly. It fit very well, but also because we could really block out the sun. We could, those could all shut down and we could shoot easily whenever we needed to. Well, when I took Dante there and I showed him pictures, actually, I had sent him a lot of photographs. He was like, well, of course we're going to shoot at night. And I said, why? He said, because I want those windows open. I want to see out. I don't want to block that out and just have a bunch of reflectors everywhere. And so I went, okay, here we go. So yeah, Dante hated closed windows and white walls. Those were, and of course that's all I gave him pretty much at the time. And I had to make him work around all that. But yeah, so that's why we had to shoot at night, because we needed to see out those windows. Same thing with Lance and Christian's house, all of those. He wants that depth. And it looks better on film.
Okay, let's go to Lance and Christian's house. Is that the same place as the apartment, or is that two separate locations?
Two separate locations. The house was a very lovely house, courtesy of my other business partner, Robert Campbell. He found that location. It was a perfect place for them. You could move around in there. It kind of encapsulated everything. It was exactly right. Great location. And then Christian's apartment. You're talking about Kyle's apartment or Christian's apartment?
Both. I thought there was the same one. Kyle and Christian.
Three separate locations.
Oh, all three?
All separate.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Kyle's apartment, it was a really cool hip place in downtown San Jose, or near downtown San Jose, near the Winchester Mystery House, actually. It's very close to that. Just a nice, cool, hip apartment. And then Danny's dumpy studio, we kind of messed up one of our other my co-producer, Tim Sika, his office. We kind of messed it all up, his office, and turned that into his studio, his cramped studio place. Yeah.
I'd be remiss if I didn't ask that wine cellar really exists in that house.
It does. Yes. And that is in the house, in Lance and Christian's house. Yeah. Yeah. I saw that. That scene originally took place someplace else in the script, and we saw that and went, oh, it's going right there. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. It's a great spot.
Now, this may be me reading into something. I find your film is very tight at times. Not the Crisis Hotline location, but every other location is tight. I find you're right up into it. Like, I literally don't have a lot of talking. Like, every time you do an interview, I feel like you've moved the camera in more, closing me in as the film goes on. Mm-hmm. When it opens and they're dating, I find you've drawn back a lot. Mm-hmm. And you give me a more wide shot. But as the film closes in and the pacing is still the same, I feel like I'm heading closer and closer to that corner and I'm not getting out of it.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. Because at the beginning, one thing that I was doing here and was anytime we introduce a new scene or new location, I always believe it's important to establish the geography. So of course the viewer knows where we are in there. But that by doing that, it allows me, then I can start varying it a lot more so that I can give that sense of claustrophobia. Everything is closing in very, very, you know, in a very nasty way. And there isn't any way you can get away from that. So yeah, that is intentional.
Now, I do want to discuss the final character whose name I'm not going to mention because you know who I'm talking about. I find you shoot him differently than you shot everybody else before he shows up.
Before he shows up.
Right at the end of the film, there's one character that kind of changes things for us. Their friend.
Yes. There's... Well, okay, wait a minute. No, I don't want to assume here.
It's the producer. I guess I could say that.
Oh, the head of everything, you could
yes,
say.
Yes, the head of
okay,
everything.
Yes. Okay, well, that character, I'll give you another little insight on that character. I wrote that character originally. I had met someone who was in my past who was similar to that person, who came off that way. And that, if you remember the dinner scene in the film,
yes.
I attended a dinner very much like that one. Very much like that. Not exact, but where I was sitting there and everybody was having a conversation and was in on what was going on except me. And they did it actively. And they did it on purpose to try and make me uncomfortable. And they basically succeeded, but it was a very vivid experience, very unusual, very strange. It wasn't nearly as threatening as that is, but it always stuck with me. So that's where that scene comes from, is from kind of an experience I had. And that guy that you're referring to, I had originally designed that to be our guy that we could get a name actor in. Okay, like someone famous.
I could see that.
Could we get somebody that could fit that spot for, we'd shoot him in a day and do it. And that proved to be difficult only in the way of timing. Our timing, we would have needed a little more time. But I will say one person that we actually considered wanting to do that part was Armistead Maupin, the writer of Tales of the City. We kind of had an in with him. We knew we could talk to him. And he did decline, but he liked the script. He actually thought it was very interesting. And he mainly declined because he says, I'm just not an actor, really. You know, I'm not, I'd be too nervous. And we totally understood. But that was our one name we kind of approached about that. But luckily, Robert Campbell, again, that name, he brought Michael Champlin in. And he was just superb. He was great. He knew exactly what the part was. He understood it completely and was not afraid to go where it needed to go at all. And so, yeah, as far as he was definitely shot differently, especially when we introduced him in that backyard.
Yes.
We actually used, there was actually, it's interesting because you're very astute. I'm very impressed.
Sorry.
Because for that scene, Dante actually used a specific lens from the 60s, believe it or not, from the 1960s. That somehow he had adapted to the Red Dragon. I don't know how he did it, but it was a very special lens that you have to really look at it. It's almost subliminal, but it slightly warps it just enough. And it's unsettling. It adds to the unsettlingness. Yeah.
Well, I find him very unsettling and it didn't mm-hmm. feel like the same shots you were using all throughout the film. So I figured you did something in editing I missed, or that's why I'm asking. Cause I saw it, but maybe other people didn't. But it's
well, I am very impressed that you saw it because yes, it is there. You're the first person that's really asked me about that actually, and noticed that.
That's a compliment.
Yes, you should. And but it was a very specific lens that Dante used for him. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It was more the lighting that threw it off for me, I'll be honest, because it didn't look like your other shots. I'm like, he's done something here. I can't tell you what it is, but I could see it. So that's why I brought it up. I said, if I remember to come up. I do want to discuss casting and the narration. I find your narrator is perfect for the film. He's got the nice voice. I feel like he's trying to solve me in a blanket all the time. He's bringing me in. He's keeping me warm, kind of like the cake metaphor, which I don't always use these things, but I find your film lends to that. And he's great. He doesn't get upset ever. Even when he's upset, I don't think he's upset. I think he's playing me. Was that your plan? Did you ever tell him, okay, I need you to slow down. You're going too fast. Pace yourself. Speak slower.
You know, the casting of Crisis Hotline was pretty wild in that we had to cast it very, very quickly. And we cast a pretty big net. We looked at over 500 different headshots and resumes.
Whew.
We looked at a lot of self-tapes. It was just a very quick process because remember, we did have a deadline. We had to start shooting on August 9th, I think it was, to have any chance of pulling off this rough cut. And so it was just very, very quick. And I got so lucky with the cast that I got. We just really were fortunate. And the thing that was great about them is they were all on board with this material because the script, the original screenplay, as compared to the finished film, was much more graphic. I will say that. It was much more graphic. And they were all in. They understood it, that it wasn't exploitive. It wasn't meant to just get a sale. It was appropriate to what we were trying to do. And so because they were all in on it, it's almost like they all got it. I didn't have to tell them to slow down, to be honest with you. They understood it. They knew what it needed. And they were, and maybe because one of my two leads mainly, which were Pano and Christian Lopez, playing Kyle and Danny respectively, they had never done a feature film. They had done, and they also hadn't really done any dramatic stuff. And they were very young, they were 22, 23 years old. And so they really jumped into it because they appreciated the opportunity and they were focused. They were hardworking. They were incredibly patient. I didn't even realize at the time how difficult it was to make a film like that in 11 days, given the new toys, because all the toys we had worked with before could fit in the trunk of a Toyota. Now we needed trucks, to do this kind of, and so that's where we got really fortunate, but the cast got it. I didn't need to tone them down actually, which was really great.
This may be something I just want the viewers to know. The nakedness. There is naked shots in this film. Were they always there? Were the actors like, yeah, we read the script. We know what's going on.
Oh, well, this is another good anecdote with that, which is, again, it was much more graphic originally. And I did what was interesting was I did do kind of a rehearsal, one of the very few rehearsals I was able to get in with Pano and Christian. And we went over that first scene, the first sex scene, so to speak. And everything's fine. They're comfortable. They get along well, there's no issue there. And I thought, okay, I think I've got this figured out. Well, we didn't shoot that rehearsal or anything. This was just blocking and stuff.
Right.
When we got on set, I was astounded at how long it takes to choreograph a sex scene so it looks decent on camera. It's almost like choreographing a dance routine, literally. It takes a lot of time. It doesn't matter if the actors are comfortable. They'll do whatever I needed to do. But I realized as I started doing this, time is just flying out the door and we didn't have a lot. So I was forced to really simplify them and scale them back, which in the end is fine. But this is another tip for independent filmmakers. Do not think you can just whip out a sex scene with two actors and it'll look right. It won't. You've got to really, it's in a way, it's one of the most unsexy things you can do. I remember Michael Douglas said that about Basic Instinct. He said, oh, trust me, it's not not a sexy, erotic scene when you're, you know, when you have to do it all. And I get it now because it's literally, you know, put your hand there and now put your hand there and now kiss him here. I mean, it's like step by step by step. And so they got very simplified in the final film just out of time. It was, they're very complicated things to do. They really are. If you want them good, if you want them to look good, yeah.
Don't shoot a sex scene. Got it. Without a doubt.
Complicated.
Your music, it's, again, I want to go back to the pacing. It's very subtle. I found it was never overpowering. The music didn't really give me a mood ever, but I noticed it underlying everything.
Yeah, the I love the score. The score is by a really, I think, a really talented kind of almost underground filmmaker named Paul Reiss. Back then he was Paul Birch. Now he's Paul Reiss. And he does a lot of interesting movies himself. And he was really getting into, and I was a fan of his. We used to run a film festival and I programmed a few of his films for our film festival in San Jose. And I just love his work. I think it's really unusual, really different. And he was starting to get into music. And when I said, because he also scores his films, and I said, hey, I really love your scores. Would you give me some music for this movie? And luckily he did. And what was great was he insisted I not pay him. I mean, I had a budget for it and everything. And he's like, no, I do not want any money for this. And I said, okay. And, I don't know if it was just a favor to me for programming his films or what, but, he did a wonderful job. And his music, the thing I liked about it is there's no way his music could ever be called derivative of anything because it's really unusual. And that's
great.
So I like the originality of it very much.
Okay. Did you ever have a different ending in mind to the film? Because I find the last 15 minutes roughly rushes. It's the first time I find I'm rushing in your film, rushing to get to the end. Not the time issue. I just felt it was time to get to the end. So did you have a different ending in mind? Because I thought there might be one.
No, there actually wasn't. That was always the ending. And yeah, without giving anything away, there is an upending of that you could say. And that was designed purposely because I always want people to have to go back and look at it again, because it does make the whole thing different once you know what has happened. And I have had people tell me it gets better. Even if they liked it the first time, they like it better more. There are more things going on than there, they said that they saw multiple times, which is what any filmmaker wants to hear, obviously.
I definitely agree. I know there's stuff I missed in the dinner scene and stuff like that. And just because it's hard for me to take notes and watch a film at the same time. So yeah, I definitely you. That. So moving on to fun questions, if you're ready.
Absolutely. Sure.
I think I covered everything on the film.
Good.
Your first time on the show, I always have to ask the same first question, your favorite film.
If I had to say my personal favorite film, my personal favorite film, what I think is the best film ever made.
Either one is fine, or you can give me both.
One of my personal favorite films would be Stand By Me, just one that I can just kind of watch
over and over again.
That would be right up there, along with Running on Empty. Those are two films that I watch a lot every year, I would say. As far as what I think is one of the best cinematic achievements ever done, I'd probably say 2001, A Space Odyssey, I think is one of the best achievements. And I think in the modern era, I really think Interstellar is one of the best films of that type, big movies. I think what Nolan did there was, believe it or not, an underrated achievement. I think it's quite a special film. I really do.
One book you would recommend for everyone to read that's into films?
Sidney Lumet's book. I think it's called Film Directing, I think, by Sidney Lumet. That book is, yeah, just if you look up Sidney Lumet's book that he wrote on film directing, definitely read that. Excellent.
And your last question, I know you're a connoisseur of film, so I think this could be an interesting question. One film you've never seen and should have.
Oh, that's a good one. One film I've never seen and should have. I'm going to say one film I haven't seen and should have. Absolutely, because I've just seen bits of it, but I've never watched the whole thing at all, is Bergman's Fanny and Alexander. I should absolutely have seen that by now. I've seen so much of his other work, and I've only seen literally snippets of it. That's wrong. I need to fix that. I confess. I need to do penance and absolutely watch. I should have seen that one by now for sure. Yeah.
And we can't let you go because I haven't told anybody where to find your film. This is your big chance to pimp yourself, so feel free.
Excellent. Well, Crisis Hotline can definitely be found on Amazon Prime Video. That's one of the easiest places. It's also on Tubi, T-U-B-I, Tubi TV. It's also on Deku.com, D-E-K-K-O-O. I also believe it's on Vudu, V-U-D-U. It's also on Google Play. And I also believe it's on iTunes as well. And yeah, it's, you should be able to find it. And of course it's on torrent sites, people, which this is another thing I will tell independent filmmakers, believe it or not, when your film gets torrented and you see, you know, 20,000 downloads of it, that's a good thing. Do not think that's bad. That means people care about it and they are watching it. It's, I mean, I know you look at it as lost sales, but I'm telling you, it's not a bad thing. My husband's been very good at explaining that to me, and it is not a bad thing. And I'm also, I guess, I'm in pre-production now on my next feature film. We are going to shoot it in the end of February of next year. And it's very different from Crisis Hotline, obviously, but it's going to be really, really interesting. My first COVID protocol experience of doing it. And we're also with it, we're really experimenting with a lot of different kinds of workflow to make a film, which I'm looking forward to doing interviews about that and explaining how, because I've never made a film like we're making this one. And it should be very interesting. And if it works, that could be a good thing for independent filmmakers.
Thank you for your time and you have a great day.
Oh, thank you so much.